Hey guys, welcome to the Cinepile Podcast, the podcast that talks about films that matter. And this is episode 21, and on this episode, we are going to be talking about La La Land from 2016, directed by Damien Chazelle. A really breakout for me, and honestly a big surprise as far as it goes, and it found an odd place, I think, in my heart, and everyone that I have spoken with, including my lovely co-host here, that La La Land is something special and something magical, and I think that it needs to be discussed. So we're going to kick it off here. So one of the important things with La La Land is a lot of people have some reservations toward it, and more so the modern era, because musicals, what? They're musicals, right? People kind of have a natural aversion to it. It's a, you know, it's somewhat girly. It's kind of old hat. What are some kind of other things that kind of keep people away from it?
It's usually men that have an aversion to musicals. So even though that wasn't always the case, that musicals haven't always been kind of seen as a feminine genre.
Right.
Like back in the 40s and 50s, actually, it was like for everyone. Men loved going to see musicals. It was like more of a spectacle that everyone saw. So it's, yeah, I guess I don't know the history. I don't, you know, I'm not a historian as far as musicals. I don't think any of us. Like we like musicals.
Yeah,
I love musicals.
Musicals.
Yeah, no problem. I just don't know. It's something I need to dive deeper into. Seeing La La Land has really inspired me to at least see more, and even more so, I just wanted to talk about this movie.
Yeah, because it's such a special film, and I think it showcases the musical genre's potential. I think it's a similar feeling I had when I saw Singing in the Rain for the first time. And just the very nature of this genre, this pretense, this complete suspension of disbelief that you have to,
if you will,
a La La Land that you have to go into. It's able to talk about art itself in a really, really creative way. Yeah, so I remember when I was a kid, and this was really young, probably like first grade, maybe kindergarten, my mom's favorite film was Sound of Music. And we had the double VHS.
Nice.
Yeah. And it's a long film. I watched it probably like twice in a row for several days. I don't know if it's because of that or just my love of film, but I've never had this aversion to musicals that I see in so many other guys. I don't see it here. I mean, you love music, you love movies, you bring them together in incredibly creative cinematic ways. Now, I understand there's some trash to the genre, just like every genre, but like the pinnacles of the genre are really great.
There's honestly probably a ton less trash than like horror. You know, like,
yeah, for sure.
Every genre, you know, has trash. I feel like musicals probably have less trash than probably other genres. And this is just me speaking from the gut, because the production on them have to be so high that,
yeah,
it's almost like a Pixar movie, you know, like an animated film. They're not normally trash because
so
a
much
ton
investment,
of forethought has to be put into it, you know, and money.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder that in terms of people who do have an aversion to musicals and everything like that, because I remember I was watching Into the Woods and I was in a movie theater and there was this dude, you know, kind of quintessential, kind of masculine kind of type of guy, like, you know, 6'3", bald, you know, very muscular. And he was there with his three daughters and they started singing, like, you know, Into the Woods, here we go, Into the Woods. And he just kind of like looks over at me and he was like, is this like a musical or something? And I was like, yeah, it is. And I was like, boom, aren't you happy? And it was just so funny, like, how I just immediately, like, kind of turned off it was. Yeah, and so, like, and, you know, there's something within our society towards, like, you know, it does have that quintessential, maybe not so hyper-masculine, but I think it's people who don't really get to watch, you know, Disney films, because as movies kind of faded out in terms of just like the whole musicality, like, you know, 60s, 70s, like it kind of got this new rail that it picked up on. And that was more so belonging to that kind of child level of entertainment because children, like, you know, obviously love that kind of thing. So I think that's where it even, you know, increases that gap, because that happened in the 60s and 70s. Then in the 80s, we saw massive, you know, violence and action in horror films. That was really their mainstay. So, like, you know, a complete quintessential opposite of what you consider a musical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes sense that nowadays, after Broadway has picked up, after a lot of these other kind of Broadway plays have kept it alive and is now coming back to the silver screen, that it's allowing for this kind of resurgence to kind of happen. You know, films like, you know, Sweeney Todd, trying to think, Moulin Rouge, Chicago.
Yeah, a bunch. I mean, and you know, you bring up a good point. I was thinking in my head when you were saying it, is we're pretty much specifically kind of talking about film musicals. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there was a time, and it's always been, musicals have always been for the stage as well, but there was kind of a time where the musical film wasn't selling anymore. Studios stopped making it. It was a kids thing, but it was still always a prevalent stage thing. But there's an aversion, I think, masculinity too, for anything that's stage related, like whether that's opera, anything that's, I don't know, it's, there's always been like a girly, like, mm-hmm. vibe to it for men.
Well, the theater and this genre, they're naturally emotive. They're usually mm-hmm. pretty emotional, and it's like the theater is the definition of drama. And it's not the definition of like physical conflict, which is what men gravitate more towards in film. Mm-hmm. If we're going to speak in huge generalizations. Yeah.
But Cinepile got scientific, and we put this to the test. Because there's one guy that we know.
And you guys know.
He's 6'1", he's 215 pounds, benches over 300 pounds, masculine to the T. And he loved La La Land. That was Gibson. Gibson loved La La Land, and he thought he would absolutely hate it. We've been wrestling with him probably for a month to sit him down and watch La La Land. And he said it was his favorite film ever.
And you did say that.
Full stop. So.
Yeah, he did say that.
What does that have to say about La La Land?
Whenever someone says that it's a movie that, like, this will be my movie that I'll watch once a year, that says a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't even watch movies once a year. I don't know. Like, I don't rewatch movies that much. So when I hear someone say that, that is powerful. Like, that made an impact. Mm-hmm. And that's really what, I mean, that's really, when I talk about movies that I like, typically it's something that I think makes an impact. If I rate anything high, it's because I left the theater feeling something from it. And maybe it's not something that musicals necessarily are more geared towards than any other genre, but La La Land specifically, I felt something from it.
Yeah,
it just absolutely had so much heart to it. Beyond the technicality and, like, you know, we'll get into more like cinematography and color palette and everything, just the spectacle that it was, it had genuine heart.
Yeah, it did. Genuine emotion. It feels authentic, which is counterintuitive because mm-hmm. it's these super stylized set pieces. But the reason it works is because that's how you feel in love. Mm-hmm. That super stylized approach is visually what love feels like and what those people feel like in the moment. So in a way, it's not even unrealistic. What's like, obviously they're not actually dancing through the stars. We're right. seeing that, but that's what people feel like, especially when you look back on times.
Yeah, it's like it's a visual poem kind of that we're, you know, that we're being guided through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's brave, and it takes, I think, a lot to put yourself out there as a creator like that.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, I think we even said this while watching it, this movie had balls.
Yeah.
I remember, I think the last time we talked about a movie that had balls was Good Time. Mm-hmm. This movie is so different than Good Time. It's the opposite, but it had the same amount of balls to me.
Yeah, well, in a way, it in my opinion, it has more balls, or at least bigger balls, maybe not more.
So on the ball scale, where are we landing?
Because, to backtrack a little bit, I went to Camera Image, and I've been to a couple film festivals, and usually, especially around award season time, what you have are a lot of really depressing movies. Mm-hmm. I think it's low-hanging fruit sometimes to make people feel bad.
Yeah.
It's not that hard to show people in terrible times or terrible historical moments, and tragedy, very important, suffering.
It's a social justice kind of film. Like, it's still, that's the easy grab as far as if you're going to get accolades or not, you know?
Yeah. I think it's a really high bar to try to make people feel good with your film. For it to still have conflict to where you care, but not to be this dreary, depressing film.
And it's a very real story. Like, I don't, you know, not to just sell La La Land as this all feel good, happy galore. Like, there's real emotions in there. Like, it's a mixed bag. You know, there's like, it's very human. It's not just glitz and glamour and happiness.
Mm-hmm. So to give a little more perspective to ourselves, we went and watched The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Cooper, you were a French student.
Cherbourg.
Yeah. It's a French musical from 1964. Huge inspiration on the filmmakers for La La Land. And I was reading about the film. You can see that it pulls a lot, La La Land pulls a lot from this film, or at least was inspired by it to a great extent. And I was reading about it, and there was a phrase I came across that I think speaks to what you're talking about, Neil. Reducing the scale to something recognizably human was what one reviewer said about Umbrellas. And I think that's what sets La La Land apart.
Yeah. Because, yeah, like Umbrellas, for one, is different than La La Land in the fact that it was almost more of an opera. Like, it was like an opera on the big screen. They sang every word. It wasn't necessarily like recognizable tunes that you were listening to.
Yeah, there's no melody necessarily.
I mean,
either.
There was some. Yeah, I mean, there was a motif that they had, a few motifs they had, but it was for the most part just
an opera.
It was an opera.
Yeah, sing song.
And like, when I think of operas and stuff, I think of big grandiose storylines with like kings and betrayal and I don't know, like something that's not necessarily recognizably like a human story that we all understand.
Right.
I mean, you understand it, but it's not,
you don't relate life. To it.
You don't relate to it on a personal level. Well, yeah, Umbrellas was very much everyone can understand the story. In fact, probably everyone has had a similar experience, not necessarily as to the extent they had, but you know, like falling in love with someone and falling out of love with someone, or falling in love with someone and didn't work out the way you hoped it would.
Yeah, which is real.
It's very real.
Right? It doesn't work. It's so crazy that it's the musical genre. We're finding these two really prime examples of the musical genre that don't play to the typical Hollywood love story. And that's what you expect from a musical.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's what made it, what makes it so easily approachable, and I think makes it so easily recommendable, because it's hard to recommend The King and I, you know, to somebody in so many respects. It's hard to recommend Mary Poppins or, you know, The Sound of Music or Chicago. You know, that it has this, it's almost overly stylized in to such a degree. And so it makes it unapproachable, like we are saying. But the film, I think it takes from all of those elements and from all of its predecessors that people would find to be unapproachable and makes something that's incredibly palatable and meaningful. I was looking up just like seeing how many like just homages are within this film, and actually the LA scene that starts out with was Another Day of Sun. It that whole traffic scene and everything like that, the director was wanting to actually make it reminiscent, ironically, of Falling Down, that film that we thought about talking about for this episode.
Interesting.
And because he wanted to first get that idea of LA being a miserable place and having that LA that we're all so acquainted with, and then making it the complete opposite. And if I can pronounce the French right, it's Les Demoiselles de Rochefort, And that whole musical number that I watch is from like the 1950s, and it's people dancing on a highway with primary colors, having a fun time with much faker looking set pieces and not as well done. But again, it's like, not as yeah, modern, yeah, but again, like the how many tips of the hat this movie has to the giants essentially that it gets to stand on the shoulders of, mm-hmm. I think it does consistently. I know the primary colors that was in Umbrellas, I know that you were taking a lot of note in, was really smack you in the face, like apparent.
It was such a great way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, like musicals in general. They lend themselves to be very colorful, and like because it doesn't have to be real life. You can make it whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
But these two films, like they have to be probably the most fun a set designer can have shooting a film. Like there's so much like leeway or so much play you can have that's not just like, hey, I need like a lamp in this room. It's like, hey, I need a lamp, I want this thing to pop, like I want this thing to just like shine on the screen. I don't know, so like everything,
can you get me a bright red lamp against this bright green wall while she's dancing around in a bright yellow dress?
Yeah.
And you got to make it all work and play together,
yeah,
and still seem cohesive.
You know, it would actually be really fun to see. Have you ever seen those barcodes to kind of look at the color of films where they take mm-hmm. every single yeah. scene? I'd love to see what the primaries and the color shifts that they have on that. It's
probably got to just be crazy.
Yeah, no,
probably
no.
like zero browns. It's all like, and well, you know, all the colors they had, very few were like pale colors. They were like rich colors.
Ironically, though, Ryan Gosling's character, Sebastian, his color palette was from the get-go, you know,
he wore the brown.
Was brown.
Brown suit.
And then,
but I wonder if that is an homage to a musician, I think it was an homage
to like more so his traditional vintage versus like modernism or postmodernism. And the fact that sure. you had Emma Stone at the very beginning, you know, dressed modern in a Prius. Mm-hmm. And then you had him, you know, rewinding a jazz set on a cassette over and over again in his like, you know, boat of a convertible, like 1980 something, while he's, you know, still in like an old kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, wool brown suit. So it's just like, I think that they just did a very good job, like kind of juxtaposing those two people in order to really characterize themselves very well and showing where this movie is trying to be. It's where it's a little bit of new and it's a little bit of old.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's a really good segue, not necessarily where we were planning on being right now, but the fact that the movie is a discussion about like, yeah, how much do you pay lip service to the past? Is this about paying homage to the past of like musicals, for instance, in this movie, or is it about doing something new and pushing the boundaries? There's a lot of layers to La La Land in this regard, especially the most obvious is talking about jazz. The movie, you know, he's a jazz musician, and there's parts in the film where he's talking about how it's dying and that he wants to keep it, and then there's John Legend, and he's talking about, well, hey, dude, like, you're too busy, like, looking at the past, like, all the people that you admire were revolutionaries, like, what are you doing to change jazz and get people to watch it? It's a dying thing. People don't want old jazz. And it's just totally a mirror. It's just talking about, while jazz, obviously, Damien Chazelle's a big fan of jazz, but it's talking about musicals. Like, it's talking about its own, it's super meta. And
It's talking about the film itself. And it's a conversation between two characters, but I took it as a conversation of a creator with himself or herself. Mm-hmm. Because there's fear there, and they discuss it at different points in the film, that you're not going to find an audience. Or that doing something that you think is great or something that makes you feel something isn't going to catch with an audience. And do you start catering to the audience? And I think we can all agree that that's a bit of a recipe for disaster. When you're just making something for an audience, you start getting, I don't know, we can go down the line of any sort of hackney entertainment. On this huge, big budget scale that we see today. So Emma Stone's character, Mia, is going to put on a play, and Sebastian gives her such encouragement to just be herself and to do what she feels and what she wants to write, and that the audience will be there for her. Mm-hmm. And she gives him similar advice back with the jazz club. And it's like about sharing your enthusiasm. And maybe this is the creators, the writers telling themselves that it's okay to be enthusiastic about a musical. I'm sure there are a lot of people telling them that it's not the right time, musicals aren't in, but obviously they're incredibly enthusiastic and they made the right call to share that. That level of enthusiasm in writing what you believe or creating what you feel, I just get that impression from this whole film that it's something that they really love and believe. And so kind of back to that discussion of art, in the film it's jazz, but you could apply it to any art. And mm-hmm. I think they're actually talking about the musical, the old versus the new. At which point do you stop clinging to the past like it's sacred and allow it to be, I guess, remixed for younger audiences or to bring people in? Like, you know, I think John Legend talks about making people love jazz by making it poppy.
Yeah, making it accessible, kind of getting a new generation of people to start listening to it. In a way, maybe that's, like, you know, it's like, so mm-hmm. is La La Land, is Damien, is he revolutionary, or is he paying lip service? Is he in between? Because clearly there's a ton of references in this movie, paying homage to previous films. Is that the goal, or is his goal more of like the John Legend kind of character?
See, I think he falls in the middle. I don't think it's black and white. And I don't think, at least my impression of it and thinking of it as something of a writer, I don't know if he was considering these things when he was creating it. I'd like to think that he and the creative partners and like Justin Hurwitz, who composed all the music, which we can't forget to mention him because yeah.
Did they say they were college?
They're college buddies, yeah.
Yeah, they had been working on this back at, like, I think they went to Harvard and they were working on the melodies and everything back when.
Wait, they went to Harvard?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I
mm-hmm.
didn't know that.
Highfalutin.
Yeah, Ivy League assholes.
Making lovely films together.
Yeah.
No, because I think that has some good subtext to it, in the fact of, you know, whether or not did Damien actually make a film that was, you know, two this way or two that way. And I agree with Kyle, and the fact that it does fall really well within that gray. But I think at the same time, and this is me kind of drawing my own theory and my own parallel, that sometimes you have to make some sacrifices to kind of accomplish the greater good, very similar to how Sebastian worked with, you know, the John Legend's band, more so he could get enough cash in a way, and then also probably because he was trying to satisfy Emma Stone's character's, you know, picture of what he wanted him to be. But, you know, that he sort of bit the bullet and was like, yeah, I'm playing with one hand, and it isn't the most, like, intriguing and most, like, technical jazz in the world, but I'm going to be able to make my museum to bring on new jazz flavor in my own kind of space, in my own kind of world. So I thought that was another good thing that he did as a director, to where he showed that sometimes life isn't about just picking a side and then just pushing through. It's about compromise, but never giving up on yourself, which
I thought
was an important thing.
It ends up he regrets doing that, and then he goes back and lives, you know, does his dream by going back to just doing jazz and having his own club, you know. In an interesting way, he ends up, the message almost at the end for his character's story arc is like, be true to yourself, and you know what he wanted was
mm-hmm.
living
mm-hmm.
in the past in a way.
Yeah, but what could be argued though, if it wasn't for him ever being in that band, he probably would have never had the capital to actually make sense into a thing.
No, I'm not. Yeah. I'm not. You know, I'm just as far as themes go.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, even maybe this is jumping a little bit ahead, but one of the things I love about this film is the third act. What in the soundtrack is called the epilogue. And in that epilogue, you see a completely different reality for both of these two characters who were in love. And that personally, as an audience member, I now love. And so this ending, I assume all the listeners have seen it now. You've had enough time, and if not, pause it, go see it. It's so cathartic, but his regrets, if those are his regrets, they don't even have to do with creating a nightclub. Because in their, it's not the perfect world, but in the world where they end up together and in love and have children, they're just two people enjoying jazz at a nightclub.
Yeah.
And so it's like there's three different dreams. There's her dream, his dream, and then the dream of being together. And you can't have it all.
Just as a side note, because that was a great point, but that epilogue scene is just...
heartbreaking.
Well, it's heartbreaking, and also beautiful, but it's just
beautifully sad.
Because, for one, it's just him playing this solo, piano solo, and that's what's telling... We're visually seeing the solo he's playing. And this epilogue is like 10 minutes, and there's no dialogue, because it's music, you know, it's like his song that he's playing. And clearly, we're outside the world of his song, like this orchestra playing, and like, you know, it's,
right.
Not, it's not just his piano anymore. But it was just, I hadn't seen, when I was first watching it, I had no idea what was going on at first. I was like, wait, whoa, what's happening? And then, you know, you reflect, I don't know, it's just, I've never seen someone visually show music. Like, it just added a heavy weight of emotion to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you said several times that how well they build the motif of that one simple song that he plays, that but da 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 da, mm-hmm. like, and how that carries through, and it can be, you know, they do it with minor keys, they do it with major keys, and they make it a positive thing, they make it a negative thing, they play it fast, they play it slow, but it's always omnipresent throughout the entire film, and they mish it and mash it to reflect ever the emotion at it. And they make it this golden thread that when you're in that club and it's all quiet and he just plays those couple of keys, it shows not only the power of the storytelling, the power of music, how much you were invested into those actors, how deeply you're involved, but it is just this nexus of the entire film on just a couple of keys, on a couple of ivories, and it just breaks you. And it's just such a fantastic execution of knowing how to make a movie.
Because it's really hard, like when you think about it, it's like, how do you show in a movie someone playing music that it's meant for two people and the other person knows what they're talking about? And it's like, how do you show that through a song?
Mm-hmm.
And
well, so they show it visually with that lighting.
Yes.
But then through the music, through the whole incredible sequence, I can't stress how incredible that sequence is. The choreography, moving, just the lights, the sound, moving from one place to another. It's got all of the possibilities of love and all of their regrets.
Or all of his regrets. I mean, she probably shares them too.
Yeah.
But it's his
right.
song.
Yeah, his song. Those regrets for how he should have... What would have happened if he'd have been a better partner? If he'd have been committed,
mm-hmm.
and had chose those different priorities along the way. And that's just, it's so human that it just hurts.
It hurts.
It hurts. And it's like, you can't turn back time.
It was our second viewing of it. I knew what was happening or what was going to happen.
Oh, I still cried.
Maybe that made it awful. Maybe that made it even worse, because when that last scene is about to happen, when she walks in,
mm-hmm.
my heart was pounding.
Yeah,
my heart like sank, and maybe that was because I knew Gib was in there too, and I was like,
oh,
he's about to get broken. Like, this big tough man's about to be broken.
But it's so happy at the same time.
Oh,
because that's part of the, it's like, it's all these regrets, yes, and you know that this didn't happen, but yet they still love each other, and it's exciting, and it's beautiful, and all of the colors and the music, and it's just, it's like, it's cinema. Yeah. That's what it is. It's this combination, this incredible combination.
Yeah, it's like the fantasy of cinema plus the authentic reality that they're living in. And I thought that one of the best moments is when Emma Stone's walking out of Seb's, and they look back, and it's not of regret, it's not of longing or envy or anything like that. It's a level of respect between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I'm glad we had each other. And I'm glad you're happy, and I'm glad I'm, and, you know, each one had a mutual respect for one another's dream that they accomplished. Because, you know, Ryan Gosling, when Emma Stone, you know, he talked her out of the pit, you know, of kind of depression, of giving up. And he's like, you're a baby, get out of here. And, you know, completely withdrew himself from his own, from the relationship, like, knew better than she did. Because in some respects, she was like, no, like, somehow we can make this work out. And he's like, no, you need to give this your all, like 100% of it. And you can't have any capacity to try to worry about me or our relationship. Mm-hmm. And you have to give this your all. Like, this is your
one moment. Well, he ended up regretting that.
Well, yeah, he ended
up. That was a part of his song.
Yeah, that was a big regret. But I think that just kind of showed that kind of maturity of kind of growing up as an adult, to where you're just making the best decision that you can with the information that you have, and just hoping that you're not gonna and I loved it. And the film, just like jazz, it was messy, and sometimes it was about one person, one person was taking it, and then it got passed off to another one, but it didn't matter on what was happening, it just mattered that was moving forward. And that's why I thought it was just a good symbol just to life as well, because it's not all playing your tune, but you have to learn how to join back in the band. In other words, it's not jazz, baby. You know? But kind of like, because we've been talking
about, where did we just go?
We went to La La Land, buddy. Like,
like, I want to watch it again.
Oh, no. I would, like, I would easily want to watch it again. And Kyle, you seem like you have something you want to say.
I'd like to take a step back.
Okay.
And talk about how incredible it is to see the third act of a film just kick you in the teeth. Mm-hmm. Like, it's pretty rare, I think, that you see that kind of powerful ending where it's like, and he did it as well with Whiplash, mm-hmm. where you don't even realize it, but it's like the whole film is building up to this moment, and it just hits it so hard. And I don't want to make this like an either or comparison, because I think they're both incredible films. But for me, that was part of where Moonlight kind of disappointed me, is I felt like the third act was all downhill. It was very...
The first two acts were super strong.
Yeah, the first two acts were really like, had me on the edge of my seat. And, you know, it was just, that they chose to go with a very quiet, subdued ending.
Which, not to start talking about another film in this episode, but yeah, it's like their probably point of view is that that's real life. Like, that's also realistic. Like, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
it is subdued and it is almost boring. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. And then, I mean, as a counter argument, it's like, but we're in the cinema, we're in the movie theater. And I want you to show me a world that, you know, I want you to show me a world where help in my escape. Relationship, well, he's escaping to this other world where all of his regrets don't exist, or where he corrects mistakes, perhaps. But it's not as if it's unrealistic in its own way.
Well, one thing Moonlight did do is it did show you a world that you had never seen before on film. That was the reason, you know, that was a huge reason why it was such a success. Like, that story mm-hmm. really hadn't been done.
Yeah, indeed.
So, yeah, it's different. Just so I'm clear. La La Land should have won Best Picture.
For real. Yeah.
But yeah, no, Moonlight is... And yeah, we're not getting into a pissing contest.
No, not either or. They're both
incredible films.
Yeah, indeed. But I think it also plays with your memory. If you're a creator out there, it's really important to leave them on a high note.
Yeah.
I think Damon serves your film. Well. It serves whatever you're doing really well, because it's the last thing people are going to remember.
Mm-hmm. Especially if it doesn't, like, La La Land's case, it doesn't necessarily give you what you expected or wanted. I don't want to say it's like a twist. It's not a twist. It's the ending it, like, deserved. It's a very, like, there is closure, and there is a little catharsis to it. I mean, you definitely wanted a different ending, and you expected a different ending. Because it's a musical and it's happy and, like, you know,
it's these two heartthrobs on the screen.
Yeah,
of course they're gonna fall in love mm-hmm. and they're gonna live happily ever after.
But then the movie's like, this is real life, man. You know, that's not what happens all the time, and it just doesn't work out all the time.
Well, and how much so that they even play with that convention and the fact that everything works out, because it says what summer, or no, spring, 5 years later. Yeah. And it's Emma Stone's by herself and she has a life together, and Sebastian's by himself and he has his life together, and they're playing with you and they know that you want it so badly.
Well, they don't even reveal that. It wasn't until like she kisses another man. Yeah, exactly. You probably expected to think that they were together.
There's a little bit of disbelief. Like, I felt like it probably wasn't gonna happen because it was like 5 years later, and I was like they're just playing with me right now. But they know what you want from just the basic convention, and you know, they could have taken that easy cookie cutter way out.
Yeah.
And they didn't give us what we wanted. They gave us what we needed.
Yeah.
They could have Sand Judah Parod this from Black Mirror.
But they didn't.
They didn't.
No.
Thankfully.
Yes.
There was an tangible energy, and like, I don't want to say it was a sigh in the theater, but it's like my memory is playing that trick on me, because I know that I was like, oh no, when I saw her kiss the other guy.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I had the inkling that this was coming, but now I know.
What have you done?
Yeah. But kind of getting away from, because we've talked a lot about story, we talked a lot about characters and everything like that, kind of getting into the more elemental base, like cinematography, editing. We talked about score a little bit. I mean, the editing, it's by Tom Cross, I thought was so incredibly crucial and fun. And there's a lot of technical editing that occurred as well. I mean, with some minor special effects or video effects. And it just kept that really nice flow to it all, towards like, you know, they use steady cams and, you know, obvious, like, you know, a whirl of a dress going in front of the lens, like using that classic cinema like take or something like that in order to keep that cut going. But to cut around the music as well as they did and to keep that energy up, and you're in your seat dying the fact that you can't dance because of the cadence of the editing and the like just enthralling funness of the score. And I just thought it was, on editing, I thought it was just really, really incredible. Do you guys have thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, all of the technical elements of the film, those technical elements of storytelling, are just, they're on point. They're just there. They're
on point. Cinematography.
Yeah. Cinematography, production design, give me a break. It just, it's like sex for your eyes. Just like, it just makes you feel good to look at it. All these colors,
yeah,
and the swirling camera movements. And it's just, oh, it's so nice.
I feel like
it's
every brave. Scene had some other shtick or some other like unique, like, hey, what if we did this, like, for the scene? I don't know.
Yet it's all cohesive. It feels like one unit, even though scenes are done completely differently.
Yeah.
And, like, when she comes out of the bathroom in the beginning, that scene that we love where the flutes come mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. and everybody's dancing like in slow motion, almost. You know, they never do that again.
Yeah.
It's not a reoccurring thing. It's a one-time thing, but it just fits so well with the style of the film. And we, when we were watching it or we were talking about it later, we kept using the word brave. And it's decisions like that, mm-hmm. whether it's in like the choreography or the cinematography, you know, like we're going to do this all in one take and we're just going to do it a couple times with a real sunset.
And we'll be here. So many long takes.
Yeah, we'll be here every night to get in. I think they said they were able to get in like 5 takes during the magic hour. And then they'd be back there the next night to do it again. All of these things is just like, it's courageous. I love it. They went big. They didn't hold back.
They did. And this was, to put in context, this was during a very tumultuous year where the world, like 2016.
was, it was our oasis.
Shit show.
Yeah. It was a rough year.
And La La Land was, yeah, it was just this like,
optimism still exists.
I don't, yeah.
It's like it was, there's still this beautifulness in the
world. I feel
like
it is what, it was the, what people used to go to movies to do. It was an escape. It was a complete escape from reality. And I mean, people still do that today, but I feel like,
well, we do it with like, they do it with like Marvel films and things like that. You know, yeah, like our escapist films are these summer blockbusters. And I know it's really cliche to harp on Marvel or all superhero blockbusters, but really those are like the escapist films. Mm-hmm. And it's not common nowadays for somebody to have faith in humanity, I think. I think that's not something you hear people talking about very much. I think we talk so often about everything that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And films do it too. Like I was saying,
it's a medium built for changing minds and shaping minds. So it's built like, yeah, to talk about problems. So there's just a ton of films about problems. But that doesn't mean we don't want a film that talks about good things.
Yeah, no.
because that's, you know, that affects people.
Yeah.
You know, that affects.
It's something like, it's something good to aspire to. Like, how many people set about to create art to make people feel good, to tell a good story, and to make people dance or sing? It's just, I don't know if I have that in me.
We were trying to think of other movies that, like, made you feel like this sense of joy. Maybe not joy, but, like, I don't know, like, purpose or...
Yeah, like, you can believe in your dreams, that you can do things. It's like, they're encouraging people. They're like...
Well, specifically the monologue scene that Emma Stone has to give for her important thing, and she's singing about, like,
Anne,
you know,
Hathaway moment,
right? Yeah, her big Anne Hathaway moment, where it's like, you know, here's to the dreamers and the poets who dream, and here's to the messes that we make, and here's to the risks that we take. And it's just like, yeah, like, you know, you can get sloppy with your life, but if you're doing it for the perceived goal of doing it because you love it, then that's something that really resonates, I think, with a lot of people, especially within, you know, the muck and mire that was 2016, within kind of like the blasé blow-em-ups of comic books that I didn't expect to fall into the silver screen of a phantasm of primary colors and dancing, swirling, whirling figures. You know, it took me completely, but, you know, it's blindsided me overall, and I loved it for that, and it just forever will have a place in easily my top five of films of all time, because it was a film that did not apologize for who it was. It didn't follow conventions. It tipped its hat to the past. It moved progressively to the future. It gave us what we needed and didn't want. You know, it's
pretty much our Lord and Savior.
Yeah, it let me enjoy Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone dance throughout the cosmos.
Well, speaking of dancing, actually, because this was a point of contention that I've talked to several people, singing and dancing, I guess, mm-hmm. but like that it wasn't good enough. Like, people were upset that it wasn't like polished enough or good enough.
That Ryan Gosling isn't actually Fred Astaire incarnate.
Yeah, he's not Gene Kelly. Like, I don't know. It's like, I honestly thought that was more charming, that their dancing and singing were, I mean, mostly just dancing. Like, I thought their singing was actually pretty damn good. Is for how, like, raw it was, for the most part. The opening scenes were very produced, but dancing, I think, adds a believability to the world you're watching. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think when you're... Because the risky thing is when you're trying to pay, like, an homage to something, that people are going to, of course, directly compare it to that homage. You know, if you're sitting there, you know, trying to do, what was it, the musical of 1940... The, you know, big dance number that they did that was on the glassy bottom with the stars and everything like that, when Ryan Gosling's reimagining what their life could have been, that you know, people are gonna come at you a little bit for that. But I think, kind of to your point, I think you have a very valid point there, to where, again, it's not trying to emulate, you know, shot for shot here. It's its own character, it's its own style. And because at first I remember, like, I kind of heard those criticisms as well. And I think after this second viewing, it wasn't, because it wasn't supposed to be that musical.
Mm-mm.
What do you think?
It wasn't about dancing.
I think those people are pishy caca. I think that's stupid. I think everybody wants to be a critic in that regard. But there's already so much suspension of disbelief that has to happen with a musical. And I just don't believe that these people... These two average lovers, one trying to be a jazz pianist and one trying to be an actress, are world-class dancers. You know, if they're breaking out these nearly impossible, like, incredibly physical dance moves, I feel like that's going to take me out of the moment instead of benefiting the story.
Yeah, it makes it into a show.
Yeah, it was about the feeling of what they were, you know,
yeah,
of their dancing, not the technicality of what they were doing. I don't know.
And it's just, if we were to go with the theory that those dance moments are their love kind of realized.
Yeah, the visual poem.
The especially like the sunset dance is like them flirting. The other dance numbers are them falling in love. Yeah, this feeling of love. It's not perfect. It's not world class. It's not going to be a gigantic musical number, right?
Mm-mm.
That's not what their love is, at least at first. And in those older films, I've seen a couple Fred Astaire movies, and I think he's incredibly talented, but it's very clearly there's like, it's almost like a kung fu film. You get to this point and it's like, okay, here's the dance number now. And for the next 5 or 10 minutes, we're in a dance number. The story stops.
Yeah.
And now we're back.
Yeah, just pure spectacle.
That doesn't happen here.
No, not at all.
I think it takes more talent in a way to kind of do this. At least on the part of the creators, not on the part of the performers.
So maybe this is an area of...
Progression?
Progression, exactly.
Yeah, for the musical genre. That the show doesn't stop. Yeah. So that we can perform the entire... It's about telling the story. And I think it's way more believable the way they did it.
La La Land, at the end of the day, is it's all about the story. It's not about the numbers. And it's not about the songs. Those are there to just tell the story. Well, yeah, some other... Not all musicals, but like, yeah, it's like you go there to see... the numbers and the songs and like, yeah, that's not what La La Land was.
No, it was very much cinema. This, I don't think this could happen the stage like and have the same power.
Yeah, if you're an Andrew Lloyd Webber fan, this isn't that kind of musical at all. It's maybe the opposite kind of musical. It's not about the numbers and the songs.
Which
it's
is
not vapid.
Yeah, it's not vapid. And that's a nice way to look at the style of the film just in general. Like, even though these things are incredibly, even though they're filled with these theatrical flourishes and one-take wonders, none of it seems to be driven by ego or to bring attention to itself, in my opinion.
Yes.
It's all in service of this story here. And the set pieces and the cinematography know when to chill out. I remember specifically the dinner sequence where it's just two shots pretty much back and forth when they actually start arguing.
The main conflict.
Yeah, it's like all of the magic of it stops. It's like everything is always servicing the mood
of the story.
Yeah, it
just becomes that 50-50 shot.
Yeah.
I think all of these people are just operating at their prime and I love it.
Well, I'll keep getting ideas and more things to talk about, but I feel like we probably need to wrap this up here.
Probably need to wrap it up in a little bit. Well, and I'll end on one final kind of point too, because even on, like, because, you know, it has, like we were talking about, it does have so many levels to where how frustrating it is that you are involved with their fight specifically, which is what I love about that 50-50 shot that they did, is that you're perfectly in the middle there. And Ryan Gosling is thinking that, you know, Emma Stone thinks he's essentially a loser who's not going to be successful. And he has this, like, idea of what he wants her to be and is trying to form that, which is actually making their relationship worse and ultimately breaks it in many ways. And just because they couldn't talk to each other. So I thought that, like, as just a film about relationships, it had that very, very... you know, important little bit there of just like just talking to each other, and it made you so invested in their relationship too that you were just like, just talk to each other. No, she loves you regardless. Like you can make it. And so like, and because they involve you in that kind of way, and you know they give you just enough and give you just a little and just too little of something, that it makes you constantly root for them, which I think continually makes everything so great because their love is your love. Their downtime is their downtime. Like their wins and follies are both yours as much as they are theirs. And it's just quintessentially one of the most masterful films I've ever seen, just because of how my perspective for a film, at least, is that I'm supposed to melt into that screen as much as possible. And the older I get, the harder it is. And it did it with such ease and grace that even on the TV, you know, that we had in our living room when we watched it for a second time. I still fell into it. Easy peasy.
That's a good way to put it, falling into it.
And that was something that really gave me credence that this movie really is magical in that respect. And, like, mm-hmm. the magic of, like, cinema really does still breathe and is still very much so alive, especially within La La Land. 9. I'm out.
Wow. Yeah.
What would you guys rate it?
This is, I think, for all of us, this is 9.
This is a 9. This is 9 material. Nine. For those who don't know, 9s are, for this group of people, our scale from 0 to 10. 9 is the highest you can go.
Ten it's the cream of the crop.
Yeah, 10 is essentially unattainable. So 9, I don't think I don't even know if I've talked about a 9 on the show before.
I think I found my first 9 with this movie.
And I can tell it's a 9 too, because this is one of the movies that it almost hurts me when I hear people say they don't like it.
Yeah.
You know, like what did you miss? It's one of those things that you just have a gut feeling about, that when you can just feel that, yeah, this is an amazing movie and there's something special to this. And it's not an analytical thing. It's just like a feeling.
It's a gut.
Yeah, it's a gut thing. And not to say, there is a lot of analytical things to it too, but it's just a total gut. Like,
because you feel like you get punched in the gut almost in some ways. When people, it's a strong gut 9. I like that. Yeah, because you feel like you're kind of punched in the gut when someone's like, oh no, it was a terrible movie. I'm like, who hurt you?
Well, honestly, I just think...
I think you didn't really watch it.
That's exactly what I think. I'm like, you didn't give it a chance. Honestly, you were done with it before you watched it. I don't know.
Yeah, or you weren't able to open up your heart to it enough, or maybe you haven't. I don't know. It's, I identify with this movie a lot.
Same.
Yeah, which maybe that makes us biased in that way, but I think there's a lot to love here. And maybe if you're one of those people out there who didn't like it so much on your first go, just go ahead and give it a second shot. Just go ahead.
And if you still don't like it?
Then stop listening.
get a psychologist, because someone hurt you somewhere in life. Well, I think it's easy to say that as we do wrap up here and as things come to an end, that La La Land is bar none Cinepile approved, and for sure that you should check it out. Links are going to be, of course, always down below for any kind of information that you want about the movie. And like always, guys, thank you for listening to us.
Yeah.
Thank you for, you know, participating in the conversations that we have. If you ever want to have a conversation, I've been having people email me recently, you know, hey, can you check out my script? Hey, can you, you know, watch this short film of mine and tell me what you think? So I want to always encourage that Cinepile podcast is here to not only just talk to you guys, but for you guys to talk to us. So feel free to reach out to me. Emails down below. But with that, if you're listening to this, if you could give us a like or subscribe, or if you could give us a review on iTunes, of course, that always helps us out a whole bunch. And if there was any thudding or bumping going around in the background, I do have a puppy in the house right now. Young little Millie.
Very adorable.
And she's very adorable. Baby little basset hound. And she wants to be on the podcast so badly. But alas, we could not let her be on it. But again, guys, I just want to say thank you very much for listening to episode 21, recommending La La Land. Ivan Cooper Carr.
Kyle Montgomery.
Neil Anderson.
Thank you so much, guys. Look forward to the next one next week on Friday morning.
See ya.
Bye.